is different than most of the talks that were presented here yesterday and today, and maybe closest to what Jeremy talked about in the first talk. The goal is how to understand emergence of the classical from the quantum. Now, the approach is in a way very much influenced, or owes a lot, I should say, to Everett. And let me qualify this, or let me be more specific. The way I read Everett, there are two messages in what he did. One of them, I would summarize with a slogan, let quantum be quantum. And I buy this completely. I want quantum theory to guide me to what it's trying to tell me. The other message, which I'm less enthusiastic about, and which in fact I suspect is not completely consistent with the first message, is there are many worlds. I will be more careful in saying what and so on and so forth, providing I get to the end of my talk tomorrow, to the end of my, to the last of my transparencies. So let's see how it goes. So, subtitle, Relative States and the Environment. Basically, the main insight of Everett was that you can avoid a lot of problems one has with quantum theory by focusing on relative relation, on the relation between states. And I would like to talk about how much and what environment adds to it. And the other subtitle would be Beyond Decoherence. Things will become clearer as we go on. But as the second subtitle implies, I will not really focus on decoherence. And to some extent, I will probably almost assume that you know something about it. Now, the subject will really come up in force tomorrow. So that you can have some reading for today evening, I brought here two stacks of papers. If you want to grab them, feel free. This one is a Physics Today from, what, 15 years ago or so. Very brief. I think you can get through it in an evening. This one is a much more detailed account. I think it will help you fall asleep. So I leave them here. If you're interested, feel free. So these are, in fact, these two. Now, there is a book which has just hit Amazon.com by Max Schlossauer on decoherence, which is much longer than the red thing and which will not help you fall asleep. And you probably can't get it by tonight anyway. So it's very well written. I think it's worth looking at. The content of my lecture would be closest to something I posted a month and a bit ago on the web. So again, you can grab it and take a look at it. Let me start by giving a very brief summary of textbook quantum theory. And let me start with two. I sort of list axioms as I would lift them from Dirac, for example. So let me start with two, and you all know them. Quantum states of a system are represented by vectors in a Hilbert space. I think the physical import of this axiom one is superposition principle. Any combination of quantum states is a legal quantum state. Every state in Hilbert space is created equal. Okay?
Did you say every linear superposition up to quantum state is a
legal quantum state? So also lives in the Hilbert
space. What about superposing two elementary particles with different spin? So you need superposition rules.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay. And at this point, given experiences of my past, of the past speakers, let me suggest here what I would call Wimbledon rules. Okay. So, in tennis match, in Wimbledon, when player doubts the call of the referee, he can challenge during the set. But that can happen only three times.
That's why I used that one already.
Two. Okay, two. Evolutions are unitary. That is, they are generated by something like Schrödinger equation. These two postulates summarize completely mathematics of quantum theory. There's nothing more you need to say to do calculations. Zero. But whatever you calculate has absolutely no relation to the real world. This is really only mathematics. So in order to make a connection, we need to say more. So the next thing textbooks say, wisely, is something that connects this mathematics with experiments. So immediate repetition of a measurement yields the same outcome. This is known as repeatability postulate. I would call it predictability postulate, because one could generalize this very easily. These three mathematics and the beginning of the measurement are, I would say, uncontroversial. It's not so good with the next one. Next one says outcomes are restricted to orthonormal states, eigenstates of a measured observable. Just one outcome is seen each time. This combination is known as a collapse postulate. So once you've defined, or once you've picked out your measuring apparatus, you have only a certain set of options. This postulate prevents you from finding out the state. Your apparatus specifies a question, you're going to get an answer to it. But if the state doesn't happen to be the answer to the question you've asked, you're going to get an answer to the question you've posed anyway. Question.
When we ask a question, we're not asking for a state, we're asking for a...
For an answer to an to a question which contains an observable. So you're not asking for a state, you are presenting a menu. And the state is going to, well, what's going to come out is one of the positions on the menu. So, how often is it going to come out is decided by the fifth postulate, Born's rule, you know that, p equals psi squared. Now, if you look at this list, the first two and the last two are not consistent. They can't live in the same universe. Right? The last few say things which cannot be implemented using one and two. Collapse, as came out yesterday in the discussion, cannot really happen. So how did people get around it? Well, Borden and Dirac essentially postulated that it's going to happen anyway. They said, look, quantum theory, the stuff that's described by one and two, doesn't apply everywhere. There are places which include classical apparata, etc., where it doesn't apply. End of story. By hand, therefore, you change the rules, and this is a good way of changing the rules. Everett came along and said, well, actually, you don't need to do that. You can have quantum theory which rules everywhere. If I am in the state I17, then the state of the rest of the universe is relative to my state and is given by this. Modular normalization. Now, this is good, and in some sense, bypasses the issue of collapse. You don't have an actual collapse, nothing non-unitary ever happens, but you perceive the collapse because, with respect to you who has in your neurons record of 17, the universe is in the corresponding state. This is a relative state. of the rest of the relative to your state. Now, this is good as far as it goes, but there are problems. And the first one I want to address is we need somehow to understand why this egalitarian principle at the very beginning, number one, doesn't really apply everywhere. Why things like bottles don't appear in superpositions of position, while electrons can. By the way, one thing I should add is this postulate zero, which deals with composite quantum systems. So allows for entanglement and so on. Question? I would love to blame it on Jeremy. But, you know, basically, as he said yesterday, if you have 1 and 2, 1 allows you to have superposition of possible outcomes. 2 forces the evolution to be linear. Therefore, every component of the initial, in the initial range of possibilities is going to be part of the final state. So this collapse postulate, I mean, nothing ever collapses. Everything happens. Right? Linear. It's going to become, I think, clearer 2 or 3 transparencies down the road. We're just getting warmed up. Okay? Complexity postulate. You, I think, know what the content is just by looking at it.
Does that equation down there, what is that? Do you have like an inner product equals a state? What is this?
Well, this is in a much bigger Hilbert space. This is describing just me, right? So what's left over is in the leftover Hilbert space, right? So it's still okay. Is it clear? Good. Okay. Now, by now, if I'm trying to say things like ever, etc., it's no longer a textbook, okay? So plan of the lectures, as I'm saying, I'm just getting warmed up. Lecture 1, I would like to very briefly tell you about decoherence, just to give you the taste of the idea, not to explain anything about it. And I would like to focus on the origin of orthogonality, of this selection of menu, which happens in the collapse postulate. I would also like to derive probability in quantum theory, I would like to derive Born's rule, p equals psi squared. That would be the end of lecture 1. Lecture 2, will first half will be discussion of decoherence in detail. Then I will go on to talk about other interpretational issues which can be discussed using decoherence. Now, why don't I just simply jump into decoherence and do it right away? Well, again, as came through in the discussion yesterday, I will just explain here basic idea and give you a flavor of why is it not basic enough. These things are more basic. And in a way, they justify decoherence, but it's better to do things systematically. So let's try. Decoherence. Decoherence, first of all, actually, is something you probably have never heard of. Ein selection, it stands for environment-induced superselection. That means selection of these positions on the, of the menu, not a specific position, on the menu. Pointer states are the things, the states which are preferred states and decoherence, this word you've heard. The main idea is systems are not isolated from their environments. And this interaction matters. And in quantum mechanics, it matters much more than it matters in classical physics. What happens typically in the interaction between the system and the environment is that the two become entangled. In order to get the state of the system alone, you therefore have to calculate reduced density matrix of the system. That means you trace over the environment. Now, what is interesting is if you fix the nature of the interaction here, wait for a reasonable of time and do the tracing, the states that appear on the diagonal of these reduced density matrices, no matter from what state you started, are the same set. So there is something special about these states which end up appearing here. If you start in one of them, it will just survive, more or less intact. If you start in superposition of them, you're going to end up with their mixture. It's just a statement of fact. You will see why it happens and how it happens in detail. So these special states that habitually appear on the diagonal of the reduced density matrix are the preferred states. They are resistant to the interaction with the environment. They are stable in spite of the immersion of the system in the environment. They hang around. So this is the essence of environment-induced superselection. Now, note these two places, one of the mathematical operation of tracing, the other, more importantly, reduced matrix. The point that I'm going to make, essentially, repeat immediately, is that this presumes, this is an averaging process. Tracing is an averaging process. When you say averaging, you assume something about probabilities. If you assume something about probabilities, it means that you are using, in effect, the fifth postulate in the list I've had before. That's the one we would like to derive. So we shouldn't start this way. I think I got ahead of myself. So let me say two things which make the counter states more specific. In the situation, simple situation, where you have well-defined Hamiltonian acting between the system and the environment, and you can ignore the evolution of the system per se, and that Hamiltonian commutes with some observable, here it's eigenstates, then these eigenstates are going to be the preferred states. And you can sort of see why. They are constant under the evolution generated by this Hamiltonian, so they don't budge. So clearly they will survive. So the promise of decoherence is it can explain emergence of the classical, in effect. The principle of superposition loses its validity. Not all the states are created equal. And there is a question.
Yes. I just wanted to check if I understood. So the statement is the following. These pointer states will survive, and survive interaction with the environment. But if you have any given state, would they, when interacting with the environment, eventually turn into pointer states? But would any
they state will they will turn into mixtures of pointer states. Yes.
So if you just let a system in any state, you just leave it for a while and let it interact with the environment, sooner or later you will get into mixture with pointer states.
That's right. Absolutely. So decoherence restricts stable states, states that can persist and therefore exist, to the exceptional pointer states. Okay? Predictability, and I'll say about it more tomorrow, can be used to find pointer states. For the time being, we can just say things which don't entangle with the environment survive. They are the preferred ones. And environment-induced superselection is a process of selection. For macroscopic systems, decoherence and selection are extremely effective. They ban unnatural superpositions. Unnatural is not defined by the taste of the observer. Unnatural is defined by the nature of the Hamiltonian that couples the system with the environment. So, why don't we start at this point? Well, the problem is that the key tool in our arsenal depends on Born's rule, on one of the axioms we would like to derive. So we shouldn't do that. It's not legal, right? So we can't use the stuff that is so useful. we have to do without it. So in fact, all of this nice stuff should be at least questioned until established on a firmer ground. So that's the aim of next, 45 minutes? I started late, right? So, plan. We would like, over the next two lectures, settle three questions. One is sort of the business end of the collapse postulate. Why are measurement outcomes limited to orthogonal subset of possible states in the Hilbert space, as in collapse postulate? Two, why does Born's rule yield probabilities? And three, how can objective classical reality, states we can find out about, arise from these fragile quantum states, right? I mean, with a quantum state, you can't find out an unknown quantum state, but you can find out an unknown classical state. And yet we want to make classical states out of quantum stuff. How does that emerge? So that's left definitely for tomorrow. We'll try to go to one and two today. So we start with why are measurement outcomes limited to an orthogonal subset, etc. It actually turns out, and it shocked me for a number of reasons, that the proof of that is very simple and can be given independently of decoherence. Normally, decoherence gives you the preferred states. Here, the necessity of having some set of preferred states arises at a much lower, much more essential level. I was delighted to hear Chris talk about no cloning, because this discussion mimics no cloning. So the other reason it surprised me is that I didn't see it 25 years ago. Okay? So let's consider two possible candidate outcome states, U and V. And let us consider an apparatus which is initially in a state A0, and all we want is that there is some imprint of that state on the state of the apparatus. Right? Now, because of postulate one, we are allowed to start in an arbitrary superposition. This will give, by postulate two, linearity, in fact, less than postulate two, a corresponding superposition of these two. Right? Trivial. So far, so good. However, the norm must be preserved. That's a unitarity complement of linearity. The norm must be preserved. If you do the squaring in the algebra, maybe I should do it. Right? You square one side, you get alpha square u plus alpha beta star alpha star beta u v a u a v plus a zero, right? Plus alpha beta star VU A0 plus beta square V, and I don't really need, I need an eraser. But I don't really need this because I can pull it out in front of the whole thing. And it's one anyway. Right. Now, on the bottom, I'm going to have a similar sort of thing. Alpha square u AU, which is 1 anyway, okay? Then I'm going to have a thing which corresponds to the cross term, and in the cross term I'm going to have alpha star beta U V AU AV plus complex conjugate. This is not 1, okay? Plus beta squared V V A square, AV, AV, which is 1 anyway, right? This stuff cancels out. All I have to do is to make sure that the cross terms are the same. This means that the real of this is equal to real of that. Okay? I can take any phases for alpha and beta, therefore really this is what I get to. Now, it's an innocent looking equation, but it has potent consequences. You can satisfy it if U and V, if this product is not 0, you can satisfy it only if this is 1. All right. So this means that if the scalar product of U and V is not 0, if they are not orthogonal, the only way to satisfy this equation is to completely fail at making any imprint whatsoever on A. So either this is 1 or U and V are orthogonal. Question?
I'm confused on my last question. So let's suppose that this inner product of AU and AV is 1.
Yes.
So I would take this to mean that really you haven't, so it's not necessary that your measurement was not successful, but that you, could I also interpret it as that I haven't completely measured these things?
No, because if you measured them completely, AU and AV would be 0. You would be able to completely, comfortably distinguish the two states of the apparatus.
Yeah.
This says something stronger.
Okay.
If you even made a small dent, it's already a problem.
Okay.
Right? Okay, so let's review. So predictability plus the basic math of quantum theory implies a restriction to orthogonal states. It doesn't show you collapse. You don't get a single outcome, but it shows you the inevitability of not being able to find out stuff. Right? You're gonna get, you know, one of the orthogonal states set somehow by this unitary process. By the way, this looks like it's completely static, but in a sense, dynamics is hidden here. This is all the question.
You assume here that the imprint you make is not destructive on the original state.
Absolutely. So this is where I use postulate 3, right? This is exactly what postulate 3 says. If I repeat the measurement immediately, I'm going to get the same thing, right? I could do a slightly more song and dance, and instead of making a single copy, do 2 copies, and then do more algebra, and I would get even more loss than I did when I was doing this on the blackboard, and the outcome would be the same. Right. So, good one. So let's review the consequences and let's think about the extensions. So derivation of the key to collapse postulate from non-controversial axioms 1 and 3. We didn't get the collapse per se, but we got the selection of the make of orthogonal states. It implies that observables which are measurable in a predictable, repeatable fashion are Hermitian, right? Hermitian observables had a set of orthogonal states. You need to attach a postulate that their eigenvalues are real. Dirac likes it. I know people who don't like it, but if you attach it, you're good. Proof is very similar to no-cloning theory. In fact, if you make one imperfect copy, without destroying the original, you can go on making imperfect copies. And if there are sufficiently many of them, they will be or as close to orthogonal as you want to the imperfect copies of the other state. Right? So if you can make an imperfect copy without destroying an original, you can come as close to perfection as you wish. It can be extended to the case when the apparatus and environment are initially in a mixed state. I won't tell you how, but it's fairly easy. One way to do it is a strategy of so-called church of larger Hilbert space. Ask me afterwards. Axiom 3, predictability is key. Information transfer need not be due to a deliberate measurement. For decoherence, the same sort of stuff is going to apply. Now, there is a simpler proof of this, which is even closer to no cloning. Basically, I could have said, well, this happens and this happens. Let's take scalar product of this with the scalar product of this. We get this equation. This is one, etc. In contrast to decoherence, these proofs do not invoke Born's rule. To be completely honest, we invoke it in a very limited sense. We say that if the scalar product is either 0 or 1, then we are certain of something. Right? So probability enters, but in a very innocent manner. By the way, a predecessor of this way of thinking is so-called information gain applied to servants. And I'm sure experts, including Chris, are here in the audience. So this is sort of information implies disturbance looked at from a very different point of view and with respect to a very different set of consequences. Now, we've finished first part of the plan. So now it's a good time to use up some of your points, Wimbledon rules points, if you feel like it. Well, either I've really confused you, or it was reasonably clear.
Oh, I could say something like this.
Please.
So are you telling me that POVMs are not appropriate measurements?
I am telling you that POVMs are not necessary to consider in the context of setting up basic axiomatic for quantum theory. And I know that I would have trouble formulating, say, axiom 3 for POVMs.
You don't have predictability. You can take that as your story.
Now, I think the way I see it, and it's a very good question, is the same as I see pointer states, right? You can write down a model in which you have no evolution in the system, interaction which commutes with a comfortable observable in the system and obliging environment. And you're going to get perfect pointer states. And things are going to settle on them and so on and so forth. Right? Now, then comes real life, which means you have to calculate oscillators other than discrete systems. And in that case, instead of convenient orthogonal states, you're going to get a bunch of coherent states, which are going to approximate repeatability. But, you know, and I don't know yet. I haven't done it. Right. So I've done the sort of, yeah.
Should we worry about the quotation marks around the objective classical reality?
Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Emphatic yes. So we are done with this, which is good. We are sort of in the setting where without using Born's rule, without employing decoherence, we define a set of events in the sense that if I have this unitary operation which satisfies axioms 1 through 3, and I'm sitting in front of an unknown quantum state, I know what are going to be the things which can happen. So now I want to find out with what probability will they have. So that's our task two. question.
Is it really that 1 and 2 are inconsistent with 4 and 5, or 1 and 2 are consistent with 3, 4, and 5 together? Because it's isn't it repeatability that demands some sort of notion of collapse?
This is a very good question, and I was amazed. I mean, this is my intuition, but this is not what you read in textbooks. This is, in fact, what you're going to read in this one, that I'm sort of confused about why do people say that you need to postulate collapse in addition to repeatability. But I think the reason we are no longer confused is that textbooks were written before Everett was taken seriously. I think, to me, repeatability is as far as I need, which is why I think, you know, given collapse model of Everett, which is don't collapse, this gives me all I need to explain collapse as I perceive it. Mm-hmm. I've used collapse too many times. Okay. Any other questions? So, on to probabilities. The intuition I shall, what's the word? Entomb? Could you pull out something that's dead from the grave?
Exhume,
thank you. Yes, is the one that Jeremy has referred to yesterday, which is Laplace's intuition. It's known as the principle of indifference, for example. So suppose I have two playing cards, and I'm sitting, you know, playing blackjack or whatever, and I know that one of them, and only one of them, is a spade. The other isn't, right? Now, Laplace said, and the roots of theory of probability are gambling, right? French aristocrats. Losing large amounts of money and winning large amounts of money, sitting at tables and doing, you know, silly things after they were drunk. So they needed somebody to help them keep their estates. So they hired really smart people, like Laplace, to help them, you know, make their bets. So Laplace says, in that situation, if you know that one of these things is for sure a spade, and you don't care if the cards are shuffled before you have dealt the one on top, you are indifferent. Therefore, your subjective assessment of probability, well, is 50-50, one half. Now, this is a very good starting point, and I will pursue it, but in a very different setting. It's very different from what you normally get in textbooks and lectures, which is frequencies. Okay? The problem with this point of view, from the point of view of physicists and many other points of view, is that it's hopelessly subjective. Now, there are people who are less uncomfortable with subjectivity than I am, but I am uncomfortable. There are fellow lecturers who are less uncomfortable with subjectivity than I am, but I am uncomfortable. So what's the problem? The problem is that if you are sitting on the bottom, under the table, you see that the physical state of this thing is changing. So, you know, yeah, it's me, it's my impression of the world, but the actual physical state is changing. The nice thing is in quantum theory, you can settle this problem. You can apply Laplace's like intuition to quantum states. How? Let me give you a very brief summary. Okay? So I have now cards sitting on two tables in an entangled state. I shuffle the card sitting on S. I'm going to call it system. I'm going to call the other one environment by the habit, but it could be Alice and Bob, whatever. Right? So I shuffle these two. They are here on this table. And I get a different state of the universe, different state of the pair. The main point is that I can restore the original state without touching my cards here on the table. How did I do it? How do I do it? Well, I shuffle the other cards. So what I get at the end is the same as what I had at the very beginning. That means that my shuffling here on the first table to begin with did nothing to the local state of the system. The reason it did nothing because I can restore the global state of the whole without touching the system anymore. Let's do it systematically. So the key point is to capture the symmetry. You do something and yet nothing happens. So the reason you know nothing happens is because you can undo whatever you did here by doing something else somewhere else to the other member of entangled there. I call this entanglement-assisted invariance, or for short, n-variance. So definition, consider a composite quantum object consisting of a system and the environment. Alice and Bob, whatever, two systems. Let me apply a transformation which acts only on S to this state. Now, when there is a transformation that acts only on E, but restores the state of the whole, then I call this state invariant with respect to this transformation. In other words, first I apply this to this, something happens, this is different than this, but then I don't touch the system anymore, I do something to E, and I get back to what I started from. You've seen that it's essentially possible on the bottom of the last previous slide. So is it really possible? Well, let's give you a very concrete example. Entangled state is an example of invariance. Schmidt decomposition. So this was introduced yesterday, also by Jeremy. An entangled state can be always written as a sum over many fewer elements than you would have thought so, naively, in such a way that this set of states and this set of states are orthogonal, and these are simply complex coefficients. The Schmidt transformation, the Schmidt decomposition is going to be essential in the rest. So these are orthogonal, and these are simply complex states. So it's very easy to see that if you had a state of this form, changing the phase of this coefficient can be done either by acting on S or by acting on E, right? This is a transformation which changes phases of these coefficients, shifts them by phi k, and it acts only on the S end of the pair. And it can be undone by rotating things in the opposite direction by the same amount, acting only on E. Any questions? Yes?
Yeah, I think that from, depending on how you look at this, the distinction that you're making is artificial. Because
what distinction?
If you go back two slides to your pictures of the cards.
This is going to cost you 2 points.
No, this is points. One objection.
Okay.
The card analogy relies on the idea that there is some under, I mean, you said that the physical situation in the classical case is different, but the state in the quantum case is the same. And I would say that that's you're comparing apples and oranges, because if you take the quantum state as analogous to a probability, which, you know, it's a degree of belief, then what you should really be comparing it to is your probability distribution over the classical states, which is, in that case, it is exactly the same.
Okay, so let me refine my statement, but let's, you know, this is, I think, a question with which you may want to come back after I'm done, because I think this stuff is going to be explained in much more detail. So the statement is, if you have a classical, completely known state of a composite object, this implies that you know completely the state of each piece.
Yeah.
State of a Cartesian state of a composite classical object is a Cartesian product of states of each piece. So this is Jeremy's point about knowing exactly France if you know exactly you from yesterday. Okay. Yeah. Now the point is, and again I'm referring to yesterday's morning lecture. In quantum mechanics, you can have perfectly known states of a composite system which do not allow you, which preclude you from knowing about the pieces. Okay?
Sure.
Good. So that's the main point. Adrian.
I might be confused, but I think there's on the second to last expression, the ETI 5H will be there. On the bottom line. There.
Thank you. Absolutely. Okay, so we agree these unitary transformations are fine. I'm going to switch it because you are looking too carefully. You're going to catch me with another error. So locally, Schmidt phases do not matter. In fact, in a sense, you know, right here we have the essence of decoherence. Without, you know, anything that decoherence gives us extra. We don't have density matrix yet. Right? We just know that phases don't matter. Okay? Now, there is a more careful and systematic way of stating it and proving it. But before we get there, and I won't spend too much time on it in any case, let's play a bit, or let's think a bit about this new funny symmetry. So, invariant psi SE is an eigenstate of two unitary, a product of two unitary transformations with a unit or unimodular eigenvalue. I can, but I don't have to allow an overall change of phase of the whole thing. Right? I don't need to worry about it. Invariants can be defined for density matrices as well, but you don't really need to have, you don't really need to worry about it, we won't. You can avoid it by using the Church of Larger Hilbert space. A product of invariant transformations is an invariant transformation. All invariant transformations have Schmidt eigenstates. I haven't proved to you that. It's true. I can if you harass me later. There may be many environments that undo the effect of the same unitary transformation on the system. So you can have a situation, for example, like some alpha k, sk, ek, ek prime, where these two belong to two different environments. And if you rotate phases on s, you can undo that rotation either doing it here or there, right? Providing this is one of the rare tri-Schmidt decompositions. Tell me.
The word invariant is used to modify both a psi SE and below a transformation of psi SE. Would that be in the third dot, bullet dot? Would that morphosite could be an invariance transformation, or do you really want the transformation to also be an invariant?
This is a question of English language I'm going to postpone. But you are an expert. You are an English major, I was a Polish major, sorry. Okay, and there were some references, and you can get to them by looking at this web paper I pointed you to it at the very beginning. So, phase invariance theorem. Now, let's do things slightly more systematically, and let me just state the assumptions that we are making tacitly and make them loudly, okay? And they have to do with the nature of what a system is and with the nature of what a state of a system is, okay? So, one, a unitary transformation must act on the system to alter its state, right? So if you have a transformation which is 1 on S and does things all over the place, I'm going to insist that nothing to S, right? If this wasn't true, all hell would break loose, faster than light communication would become possible, etc. Right? Fact 2, state of the system is all that is necessary available to predict measurement outcomes, including their probabilities. I'm not saying pure state of the system. I'm just defining or postulating existence of something which is going to tell me outcomes. And if I have a composite system, then I'm going to also postulate that a state of the composite system is all that is needed available to determine the state of each piece of that composite system. Right? I think all of these are eminently reasonable. I think we take them for granted, but it's good to spell them out. So now if you have this sort of thing, the argument goes, you change phases of these coefficients by acting on S, for example. The global state changes, but you can restore the global state by acting on E, so that you don't do anything to S. As the global state is restored to what it was before you did something to S, the local state of S must be restored as well. Okay? So by using these extra assumptions and quantum mechanics as we know it, we can convince ourselves that only absolute values of these coefficients matter. Phases don't. By the way, same information is hidden here in these pairs as in the reduced density matrix. But we don't know that P equals psi squared. So that's what we need to do next. So at this point, we are back to Laplace. Not quite his notation, but you know, close. So let me consider a case where I'm going to argue that probabilities should be equal. I've written it out here in great detail with these phases, but you know, because of what we know, I can drop all these phases. All right? They don't matter for the local state. Now, focus on the yellow part. Let me consider a transformation which I'm going to call a swap. It's going to exchange SK with SL. Okay? Now, if the coefficients are not equal, if this happens, I can't undo it by acting anywhere else. But if the coefficients are equal, I can, of course, undo it by swapping the partners in the environment. So in case when the coefficients are equal, swaps are invariant. That's the crux of the whole story. And I'm going to skip this, you can ask me. One can do it sort of step by step, very painfully and carefully, and it's been written up in places, and this is a sort of abstract way of convincing yourself in even more detail that if the coefficients are equal, probabilities must be equal. The bottom line is that if you start with this state and always the first member is the system, the second is the environment, right? So system, environment, if you do the swap, the probabilities must have swapped, and you know that, sorry, I should say it in a bit more detail. You know that by, you assert that if you have Schmidt partners in a Schmidt decomposition, probability of each of these two partners is the same. That if you detect one here, you get the other one, if you do them the next measure, right? So probabilities must be equal. So if you do that, probabilities must have swapped because you now paired them with the new guys, right? But they must be the same because you can restore the whole thing by doing a swap on the environment. So you get the same global state, so they must be the same. I think you were convinced probably better before I explained it to you. Question or just appearance?
No, a question.
Please. Yes.
So you're speaking with under the assumption that only like local interaction with the object can state can change the state.
Yes.
You deduce that the phases don't matter in the sense of composition. But I'm sort of confused. Is this basically just locality saying that you can't interfere? So I mean, what about because the phases do matter? Or am I just
Phases don't matter locally. things that do matter globally.
Okay, so that's
yes.
The point.
That's exactly the point. That's right. Yeah, in fact, you do it somewhere else to be able to restore the initial state.
Well,
in a global state.
Interference is a global phenomenon rather than a local one.
Interference in things which are entangled is a global phenomenon.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I'm just missing why the detecting zero in S implies zero in E should be obvious. Why should we assert that?
Oh, if I'm saying entanglement, right?
But that's a statement about measurements and about probability.
That's a statement about probability. That's a statement about certainty, special case of probability.
Okay, so
right. So if I measure zero here, I know for sure that there is a state. That there is its partner somewhere there.
So for instance, we should take as an axiom that if the state of the system is zero, the probability of observing zero is one.
Yes, zero. Yes. Okay. And you missed the first part of the lecture where it was expounded at. Repeatability, I think, is a connection. I think I'm glad you brought it up. Yes?
You do assume here that, by now saying that, okay, sorry. You define here that there is a probability. So you say that if you do an experiment, you get only one outcome.
Yes. So I blame it. Let me at this point blame it squarely on Everett. Right? So I'm here in the state A0 or I0, right? And here in front of me is this S entangled with this E. Right? I don't know S or E, but I know S E as a whole. And now I'm sitting here choosing my apparatus and scratching my head saying, now can I use these global properties of this entangled SE state to predict what branch I'm going to end up with and with what probability. And I say, aha, in the situation where the coefficients are equal, it must be so that the probability of ending up in either of these two branches, so me being I17 versus I16, are the same. Okay? So that's symmetry. So by normalization, as in cases where the absolute values of the coefficients are equal and there are n options, you end up with probability of 1 over n. Okay? Now, you know, I took a while to prove to you something that you would have bought if I just said, ah, yeah, that's how it has to be. But I think it's really the hard part, establishing clearly, you know, what Laplace postulated but couldn't establish. And the amazing thing to me is that in quantum theory you can do that. So, symmetries can reflect ignorance. That was Laplace's way of doing things. We know it wasn't satisfying for a physicist. But quantum mechanically, we can do that. And the point is that this local transformation, which affects, potentially could affect the state of the system, doesn't really affect it in the case when the coefficients are equal. Because you can undo it without acting on the system anymore.
Can I pose question number three?
Please.
Because I can't concentrate on this because I'm thinking.
Good, that was it.
I'm back at the interference thing. Is this sort of an approved phenomenality? I mean, because you do have interference, you're saying it's not a local phenomenon, but then I guess you're saying that you have to have a non-local phenomenon. Is that?
I'm not sure. Can I beg off with just saying I'm not sure? Thank you. I won't count it as your question, as a result. The camera wasn't accurate enough to decide if the ball was on the line or outside. So, I'm going to claim that this follows, and I'll tell you exactly how. Swaps do change entangled state. Phases matter, which is what you wanted to emphasize, but they matter globally. Whoops, I've done something wrong. Now, this is why you really need this extra thing, right? So for example, if you were to do a local swap only on this thing, no I, you know, you get back the same thing. But if there is a phase, you get, in general, a different thing. In particular, these two are orthogonal. Right? So you really need to get rid of the phases to be able to say probabilities. But to be able to say additivity, to be more precise. Okay, so we've done things for when the coefficients are equal and where you have no doubts. Now let's be more ambitious. Let's look at the case when the coefficients are unequal. And I'm going to start with a contrived example, which is going to generalize. Okay? So here's my initial state. The system has only two states, 0 and 2. The environment has three states, 0, 1, and 2. But I'm going to start the environment in a superposition of 0 and 1. The coefficients are chosen with amazing foresight to be square root of 2/3 and square root of 1/3. Okay? An auxiliary, so what I want to do is reduce this case with unequal probabilities to the case of equal probabilities. And I'm going to do that by attaching an extra environment, auxiliary environment E prime, which is always going to be the last ket, and which is going to interact only with the E in a controlled knot-like way. So in other words, generalization, obvious generalization of controlled knot is K control 0 target is K K. Okay? In other words, 0, which is in here of the extra environment interacting with this 0, gives me two zeros, 0 of the environment and 0 of the environment prime. 1, which is here interacting with this 0, gives me 1, 1. And 2, which is here, gives me 2, 2. Okay? Now, the only ambitious algebraic operation, I scratch out this square root of 2 with this square root of 2. And now I have a superposition of three different possibilities. Moreover, this superposition is invariant under swaps. Providing I swap this, say with this, I can undo it by swapping the extra environment, or this with this, likewise. Okay? This means that these three states must each have probability of 1/3. So probability of 2 in particular is 1/3. 2 alone in the system is 1/3. Okay? Now, probability of 0 must be therefore 2/3. And I deduce it actually not because of additivity, but because it must complement what I've had here. So I can get by with a very modest use of additivity. I derive additivity using this, providing that the sum of probabilities of everything must be equal to 1. But, I mean, the big point is that this stuff is a square of this stuff. So I get Bohr's rule. Probability is equal to the square of the amplitude. This is basically it, right? Instead of having square root of 2 over 3 or square root of 1 over 3, you can consider, no need to assume additivity. You can consider instead these sorts of states where the probabilities are anticipated to be commensurate. I can go through the algebra, which mimics exactly what I did before. Notation gets hairy, but the ideas are exactly the same as I had before. And I get that the probability is equal to the amplitude squared. Adrian.
Can you still get away in this more general case without seeing additivity?
Yes. Yes. You sort of do the same thing as you did before. You back out, you start with a single event, and you kind of back it out step by step. There's a little bit more. I won't tell you that. It's written up carefully in a paper which is way too long. And it's in Physical Review A. 2005? Okay. But you can get out, right? You have to assume a little bit more about, you can't talk about it. So you get this. You get Bohr's rule. General case, okay? General case. Well, first of all, you might say, look, there's no evidence, and there can be no evidence for probabilities other than commensurate probabilities, right? But, you know, that's kind of a cop-out. So in the case where these coefficients under the are not square roots of rational numbers, you can just say continuity. Now, it's a different assumption. For example, Gleason, in his derivation of Bohr's rule, doesn't really need continuity, at least not in as strong a sense as I do it. I do it. I need it. But he needs additivity in a much stronger sense than I have. Like, he basically starts with Kolmogorov's axioms. And if that worries you, don't be alarmed. Lecture's going to be over in a couple of minutes. Okay, so why the proof works? Need to know how to relate quantum states and events. So the symmetry breaking we introduced in the first part of the lecture gives us events without requiring us to say pointer states as derived from decoherence. Okay? We didn't want to use decoherence, let me remind you, is because decoherence presumes Bohr's rule. Right? So we need to be honest. We don't want circularity. Oops. That was the second point. Yeah, need to prove that phases of the coefficients do not matter locally, given the persistent questioning, which I'm grateful for. Let me emphasize it. So otherwise, swapping alter states when absolute values of coefficients, even when absolute values of coefficients are equal. So decoherence without decoherence was that part of the discussion. Summary. So we talked about new symmetry in the second part of the talk, and variance of joint states of quantum systems. I didn't emphasize that, although it kind of popped up there. It is related to causality. In quantum physics, I envisage sort of the most important part of the summary. Perfect knowledge of the whole may imply complete ignorance of a part. Right? We know that, but I mean, here we've made use of it. We knew that forever. We knew that since, probably Einstein, EPR, and definitely since Bohm and so on. But here we've made use of it, not just said, well, too bad. Bohr's rule follows as a consequence of invariance. Relative frequency of interpretation of probabilities naturally follows. Now, how naturally, you can find out by looking at one of my papers. And since this is a school, if you feel like a homework, if you feel like a homework, try looking at or deducing relative frequencies in an Everettian setting using this. Right? It's a very different for your information. Attempts to do that, starting with Everett, failed within the Everettian framework, but either essentially because there was no way to relate coefficients to probabilities. And frequencies alone of branches were not enough. So invariance supplies new foundation for environment-induced superselection decoherence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So next time, we can start back with our plan because we are done with one and two. Now, before we get to objective classical reality, which I appreciate worries some. We're going to talk at length about decoherence because we now have the right to use Bohr's rule. Sorry, we always had a right to use Bohr's rule. Now we know how to derive it from the very simple axioms. We always had the right to use Bohr's rule because in some sense, Bohr's rule is not as objectionable as collapsed postulate. It just implies an averaging procedure. And there are many people who think that that's a good way of doing business.
So let's see here. What have you sacrificed by doing that? It seems like now, instead of an additional postulate, what you need is there are these fictional environments that you can tack on.
It's a possibility of touching of attaching external environments. You don't really need them. You don't need them, right? All you need them for is to explore the algebra. So symmetries of the local whatever.
Postulate zero said is what lets you do that, right? Like you have tensor products.
Yeah.
But then would the Born rule still apply for the wave function of the universe?
And on this question, you've exhausted your third.
Are you gonna
answer it? No. Thank you, though. Question.
Is it important to consider systems that can be say bipartite entanglement systems in this analysis? And if it is important, does the analysis still go through because you lose this Smith decomposition?
You mean tripartite systems?
Yeah.
And it is important, and you will lose it. And so this is actually something that I should have commented on, and your question gives me a perfect opportunity to do that. So part one of the talk gave you a proof that if you want to have set of states of the system and glean even a little bit of the information about them, correlate them with something a little bit, in order for them to stay put, they had to be orthonormal. But if you don't do a perfect measurement, after gleaning a little bit, if you do the Schmidt diagonalization, the things which are gonna appear under diagonal in the system are not going to be the orthogonal state which are not perturbed. They are going to be something else. Okay? So the way I view it, and I don't want to, I mean, it's sort of almost another 10 minutes that I could talk about, and maybe we can come back to it next time. But the way I view it is the following. What you want as outcomes are things which are predictable, the things which came out from the first part of the lecture. What you want to be able to is assign probabilities which are additive. You will be able to do it only when the environment interacted with the system long enough so as to make the states which are not touched by the environment coincide with Schmidt states. Right? So you will be able to violate additivity to the extent to which decoherence was not consummated. Okay? Please.
In your finding of Born's rule, you have silently assumed that there is a particular Schmidt decomposition to which these probabilities belong. But in general, you could use any Schmidt decomposition, right? And in general, there is more than one possibility. So how do you choose to which basis these probabilities belong?
Yeah, it's related to my previous. So in other words, what you are saying, especially in the case where I have equal coefficients, you know, I can do anything which is orthogonal in this Hilbert space, and there's going to be a bunch of stuff which is corresponding to the other Hilbert space, right? So that's another piece of evidence for saying that Schmidt decomposition is not a good way to select your preferred states. And I think this, Jeremy touched on it yesterday, right? I mean, what's on the diagonal of the density matrix isn't necessarily your preferred states. What doesn't get changed by the environment are your preferred states. So if you have your apparatus, it's going to correlate in a particular way with the system, and you're going to know that from the nature of the interaction between the apparatus. In fact, to make things more accurate, what you really predict is not the states of the system. What you really predict is the states of the apparatus pointer, and you correlate them with previous states of the apparatus pointer. So the decomposition concerns the system which involves this, concerns a composite which involves system, apparatus, and the environment of the apparatus. And you make the cut which defines Schmidt decomposition between the system sorry, between the apparatus and the environment. System apparatus, a part of the same system, right? So that's sort of where the orthogonality and choice of what are the real things enters. And that's where repeatability is essential. You want to have the memory of the apparatus to have the property that you can read it off without messing it up. With a system, I mean, if you talk to experimentalists, they say it takes a lot of money to do it, and they haven't been able to really use a good accuracy. Well, I mean, the basic point is fairly simple. I'm just going to state the basic point. Okay, so if you have two systems, you know, one of these facts that I listed as the assumptions that allow me to prove things are that in order to change the state of S, you need to act on S. Right? So even if S is entangled with something else, acting somewhere else is not going to change this abstract underlying state of S. Now, if this wasn't true, causality would be in trouble, right? Faster than light communication would be my next part. Jeremy.
This is a sort of vague pair of questions that are perhaps related. Is there some way in which this stuff can be written, yields a theorem that partial tracing is the unique way in which to define the state of a component given the state of the whole?
Yes.
Because there's some sense in which, you know, when we talk about partial tracing, it's precisely in order to get probability for a subset.
Absolutely.
Defined by,
yeah,
described by its own,
that's right,
state equal to the,
yeah,
probability.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're in some sense deriving Gaunt's rule, you must,
yeah,
be perhaps,
yeah,
rewritable,
yeah,
as a theorem that says partial tracing is the unique mathematical operator,
yes,
that's the blah blah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the inelegant way of doing it is basically go back to Landau and say, now I've proved Born's rule, right? So averages are given this way. So, you know, if I average over there, nothing should happen here, etc. And, you know, you get this as a partial tracing. I think there is a more elegant way of doing it, which is basically looking at local objects which are invariant under what you're doing there. And you should get the same thing, but kind of without.
There is a
roundabout.
Okay, so my second vague question is, on the face of it, that this very neat leading idea that I can detect what's physically real locally,
mm-hmm,
by being a sufficient condition for it being something being locally unreal, that it can be moved about,
yes,
and then reversed,
that's
by,
right,
action elsewhere.
That's right.
Because action elsewhere shouldn't change the real state. I mean, this is,
that's
why,
right,
Chris Fuchs' Einstein quote.
Absolutely.
Being thus.
Yeah, I want the quote, by the way, Chris.
How much do you want?
What beer do you drink? Oh, yeah, Jeremy.
But in a way, recovering by action elsewhere the total state of the composite is sufficient, but perhaps not necessary, for retaining the local state. I mean, if one has some prescription or conception of the relationship between global states and local states,
mm-hmm,
then it's enough to change the global state in some such way that nevertheless leaves the local state the same. You know, so maybe this leading idea can be generalized so that you consider action elsewhere, so which, while it doesn't wholly reverse the global state,
uh-huh,
and recover the initial global state, it changes the global state in a limited way that leaves the local state the same. But of course, to talk about that, you need to have some formalism for local and global states and their relationship, which in a sense is not on the table yet because you haven't got the partial tracing.
Well, I think you've put your finger both on an interesting question and the reason why I can't answer it. Right? I mean, what I wanted to do is to derive probabilities without having to postulate them, or at least, you know, postulating them in the very special case where probability becomes certainty. Right. So I think, you know, it's your it's one of these postulates, fact three, which kind of is at the heart of your question. But you know, as long as you do things for sure, you can do them without. I mean, the way I've done them. If you start being, if you depart from zero and one, things become conceptually more difficult. So I haven't done that.
Okay.
We should probably wrap up the session now, so let's make it.